Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by shipping cheap parts around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Skip the tariff and snag yourself American-made clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small caps. So big welcome again, Paul.
Thanks, Paul, and hello, everyone, and I hope you like my new camera. We've got upgraded IT at my end, so hopefully it'll
work. Yeah, 4K, Paul Scott. Wow, I'll give a big five for that. Thanks very much. Anyway, we've had a really crazy past week in terms of corporate reporting, geopolitics, central bank decisions, and we've even had a state visit by the US president. So putting all that together, anything sort of caught your eye, sort of key themes over the past week or so?
Well, I mean, the macro stuff, I sort of give it a glance, but I don't think there's anything that particularly changes the investing outlook on the macro side this week. The main thing that I'm focused on is the individual companies, and it's striking how almost everything is reporting inline results and inline outlook. So actually, I think so far, the September reporting season is actually going rather well.
Yeah, I've got a slightly different take, actually. I think there has been a few sort of like profit warnings, actually, or sort of like softer statements. I mean, we've got a few of them we'll go through this morning.
Yeah, there's a few, but not a deluge.
No, it certainly hasn't been a deluge. No, I mean, I would sort of my biggest take, I mean, obviously the central bank decisions out in the by the Federal Reserve yesterday and the Bank of England today were pretty much nothing burgers. They were all predicted and well signaled by the market. Yeah. However, what it does do, it sort of cements the view that the second part of the US mandate, which is sort of like full employment, is actually starting to weaken. And that's why they reduced their interest rates. And you can see, obviously, the employment, even on this side of the pond, also not strengthening anyway. It's slightly getting softer. And with more sort of companies, sort of like a few of them sort of like having profit warnings, it's certainly not an absolute sort of torrent of them. I just feel as though we've probably now seen the highest of the interest rates. If anything, I think the direction of travel for interest rates are, I mean, that's probably nothing new to people, but are likely to be down. The only danger you get is any latent sort of entrenched inflation in the country, because we've had like 4 or 5 years of, or 3 years or 4 years of inflation, and people, the consumers, have now got used to sort of like mid-single digit average inflation. And if that, again, is built into salaries, and that, I think that's what the central banks are just fearing, is that do you get that entrenched inflation? But I do think we're past the worst now. I think, actually, it looks as though we are going to see interest rates coming down, which should be good for small caps.
Yeah, I mean, I, like I said, I just don't think there was anything noteworthy that wasn't expected. So that's all I'm saying, you know.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, we've had a really busy week too, speaking to different management teams. And yesterday we managed to catch up with PCI Pal, who Valuehound was asking about last week. The CEO, James Barnum. These guys do sort of like security software that helps contact centers securely take payments on cards or through sort of like digital wallets and all this sort of stuff. Have you got any sort of key points from our conversation from with James?
Yeah, I mean, you tend to do the detail on these calls we do together. You really drill into the business model and the specifics, don't you? Whereas I'm more kind of overview, taking a step back. So yeah. I listen intently to what you and James were saying, and it was just made me realize how little I understand about this business, even though I've followed it for years. I've always taken a broadly positive view on PCI Pal. It had this decent recurring revenue growth, which meant that even though it made losses year after year, it did have a roadmap towards profitability that's just about got there. The frustration is obviously that they then decided to spend a load more money for marketing and it's going to go back into a loss next year. Mm. So we challenged the CEO on that, but he said, look, we're doing this for commercial reasons. We've got to do what's best for the business. We can get the key point for me was 20% ARR growth. He thinks he can achieve with this extra marketing spend over the next, I think, 3 to 5 years. Now, if you do the sums on that, this business will be worth a lot more in 3 years' time. So I think I know quite a lot of big shareholders in this personally, and they're very frustrated at the time it's taking and the languishing share price. But my overall view on this is broadly positive. I think it's on the way to a higher valuation, but you might have to be patient. So what did you think then, Paul?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I mean, I thought it's very cheap for a software company. It trades at about 1.5 times sales. I think there's a good and strong and growing addressable market. I mean, we did actually probe in quite hard in terms of what AI and the chatbots would mean in terms of billing, because it's done currently on a per seat basis. And how would they charge that to a per chatbot basis when actually payments are taken by, you know, computers rather than actually individuals? But he had an answer for that, because he was going to bundle it all into transaction and do sort of like a value add. So that was good. He also sort of like, we discussed quite a lot about one area that I had, which was a bit of a red herring, which is the unlimited level of payments for contactless cards, you know, so tap and go cards, and where the government is putting that. And he said, look, actually, we already sort that out, and it's not going to make any difference whatsoever. It's a total red herring. So, and I took that. And then the real sort of inflection point, which came out for me, was they've really got quite a heavy software engineering team there.
Yeah.
The reason is because the onboarding of new customers, and particularly partners who they sell through, take about 5 months to get from sort of what's contract signature up until go live, because there's quite a lot of customization, teaching, education, learning the specifics of the software. And his vision is to get that down to an out-of-the-box type or a one-month type solution. Yeah. He does that, he'll then be able to jettison a lot of that heavy software, you know, sort of revenue. I'm sorry, software cost. Because, I mean, they do £24 million turnover. And frankly, I've seen some very profitable software, SaaS software businesses, you know, extremely profitable on that type of revenue. He isn't. It's because he's got this sort of like this lag for the of extra software cost. But there is a plan for that. So I came away that he was hungry, he was energized, and he had a direction of where he was heading. So if all things go well and he manages to solve that implementation and cuts it down from 5 months to 1 month, or then I think this will be valued at 3 times, 4 times sales on a higher revenue. And on that basis, you could easily see, you know, the shares getting to 150 from 50p now. So I came away like you. There's a real opportunity. I mean, it's not a dead cert, but it's a real opportunity here.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. I mean, I think that he's what I like to see in small businesses, a hands-on, intense, focused, passionate entrepreneur, you know, who's he knew all the detail on everything, didn't he? He didn't say, I'll have to refer back to my COO or anything. So, no, I think it's good. It's on my possible buys list. I wouldn't say for me it's a compelling buy at this stage, but I don't know. Have you bought any, Paul?
No, I haven't. No, I'm pretty heavy on the old tech at the moment, and I'm still sort of got a bit PTSD from payments generally with Argentex. It's sort of like an area that I'm very hesitant at the moment.
Yeah, and just one final point, actually, I was worried that call centers are sort of old hat with everything moving online, but it was interesting how they're tweaking this product to work, as you said, with chatbots and with automated payment lines, and they've got some lovely new fraud prevention products coming in through the product development thing, which I could see being very popular. So yeah, broadly positive, I would say.
Okay, good. We've got a couple of questions coming in. We've got SE81 and Steve Walters asking about speculation that private hospital operator Spire Healthcare is going to get bought, because I think there was a Sky expose this morning saying that their shareholders were itching for a sale of the actual business. I don't know whether you saw this one and whether you've got any thoughts on a potential sort of like acquisition of Spire Healthcare.
Spire, I put in Shire. That's why I didn't come Spire, up. Well, you're probably the best one to speak on this, Paul, because you called it correctly from the lows. And this is our friends at Harvard, isn't it, who are agitating for change. So do you want to – I haven't really got anything to add. So do you want to flesh it out, Paul?
Yeah, let me just – I'll just put the chart up just to show what people's what the company's done. There you go. Basically – About the start of the year, it had a bit of a profit warning because it had to absorb all the input costs from the NI, and it wasn't managing to transfer that onto pricing. It is actually now transferring those pricing through renegotiations, say like with the NHS, because they're 12-month sort of contracts and stuff. So the shares have rebounded. The thing is there's a significant value upside. I am a shareholder of Spire, and personally, I think the actual, you know, if you do a sum of the parts, minimum it's 270, and that's just on a net tangible book value. And actually, this is really quite a hot area for particularly private equity type infrastructure investors, because you just see how much they've bought out with sort of the GP surgeries. You know, they've been bidding heavily for that. There's no reason why they don't bid heavily for this. So I can understand why two activist shareholders are interested in encouraging the board to look at potential strategic options. And if they do that, then I think this will go for £3 myself. But hey, you know, it's still a long way. This is speculation, but clearly investors want to see some money and they believe that it's undervalued and there's buyers out there. So they're pushing the board to actively look for those type of, potential interested parties.
Yeah, sounds good. So yeah. I haven't got anything to add on that one. I think you summed that up well, Paul. Yeah.
Okay, good. We got a question on Tony. He's asking about Bango. They came out with results this week, and we actually luckily had a chat with their management team. And I have to apologise because I did actually give the CFO Matt Wilson and the CEO Paul Larby a bit of a hard time, I think. But
you were quite harsh with them, weren't you?
I know. Yeah, I was a bit harsh, so I apologise publicly to them for that. But anyway, they basically do two parts of the business. They've got direct carrier billing software that allows people to buy things over them for their mobile phones, and it goes onto their bills. And then also, it's got a much more interesting digital vending subscription type software business that aggregates things like Netflix and Amazon Prime together and allows telcos and other retailers to sell those into a broader sort of bundling product, which is absolutely flying off the shelves. What was your take from our conversation with the management team?
Well, not much different to when we last spoke to them, because we were already pretty fully aware of the story. I should add that, just for full disclosure, that I've been a Bango shareholder myself for several months. I think we spotted this. We were a little bit ahead of the curve on this. I think we spotted this in June, didn't we?
Yeah.
And saw that there's an opportunity here, but it wouldn't become apparent until the 2026 numbers. So I bought in around 80p. So I'm quite pleased with that because obviously 50% up. Now, it has surprised me that it responded so strongly. If you look at that big spike up recently, it's two impressive contract wins that came at a day immediately after each other, including a very large one in Africa. And then the results were in line, I think. But something while we were waiting for you to join the call, Paul, because you confused everyone with the start time. But, but I just made small talk with the CEO and CFO. Yeah. And I said, oh, you know, how's it going? Are you busy and everything? He says it's manic. We've got 8 days of back-to-back investor meetings. And I thought, and the penny didn't really drop. But then afterwards, I thought, that's pretty incredible for this size of company. There's a lot of institutional interest in it. And then I read on a bulletin board somebody saying apparently they're doing a 10-day investor roadshow with Canaccord. So this thing seems to be getting noticed. And I've got a fair value on it personally of between £1.60 and £2.40. That's my sort of price target with a 12-month type view, if and only if, obviously, they hit the forecasts. I think it's credible. So yeah, how about did you buy any, Paul?
No, I didn't know, but I would agree. I mean, I think a fair value for this is £2 plus, and I'd put a pound for the direct to carrier billing product and a pound for the digital vending service. And that, yes, they're going to sort of like suck in a bit of capital and they'll increase the net debt over the next 6 months. But I think that's going to reach the bottom of that. It's basically working capital going out. If they can get back that direct carrier billing into sort of like organic growth, which they think is going to be mid-single digits, high, sort of like 10%, so 5 to 10%. And then continue with that digital vending machine at sort of like, you know, 10, 15, even potentially 20% organic growth with all those contracts, then, yeah, I mean, this should really drop through to the bottom line. The only slight sort of like sort of minor sort of blot on the copybook on when the results came out was simply, you know, and I think it was the broker took their EPS down, didn't they? Because it hadn't actually hadn't factored in the depreciation and in the interest charge, which was about £1 million, I think, each. So that went down, but they didn't touch the EBITDA or the sales. I think that was still sort of like
that was the key thing, wasn't it?
That was still humming along.
And as you challenged the FD quite hard on that, and as he is relatively new, so I think he wanted to kind of get the forecasts rebased at a more prudent level, which is fair enough. And a slightly downside point is you'd need to be aware they do capitalize a huge amount of development spend.
Yep.
So for that reason, I ignore the EBITDA number. But the PBT number, they're adamant, they've lowered costs and they've got these new contracts coming in with good, strong annual recurring revenue growth again, a bit like the other one we were just talking about. So I think it should come through in the numbers in 2026, all being well. And we're not that far away from 26 now. So this is the time of year, the autumn, where investors generally start to rebase their sort of price targets on next year's numbers, and I think that's what's happening with Bango. So far so good.
Yeah, and I could see them splitting off those two businesses in the fullness of time anyway, because I think they've only got it's commonality in customers, but frankly they support two different sort of activities. So if there was a good offer for that direct carrier billing, I think they'd sell it and concentrate.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's one of those nice situations that I like, where you've got the growth engine being kind of masked by a staid, the other business, the billing business, is still growing, but it's the DVM division that's the exciting bit, isn't it? Because that is really scalable and operationally geared. So, and it's kind of a bit hidden, which I really like. I think people are starting to spot it, and that's why the shares are re-rating. So all good stuff.
Yep, good. Okay, let's switch sectors to consume. We've got Richard Leppington. He's saying, what on earth has gone wrong with Pets at Home? Came out with I think it was a profit reset, and they decided to, they've thrown out the CEO, I think, as well. What's your take
today
on what? Basically, this is a retail of all things pet, and also half the businesses, veterinary practices as well. But shares are down 15%.
They are. Yeah, this is bloody annoying. Sorry, excuse me. This is jolly annoying because I've got a small position in this personally. And they keep doing this. They keep slightly disappointing the market every time they update, and it just pulls the shares down. It's actually a vets business, a highly profitable, growing vets business that's performing well. That generates more than 50% of the profit with a kind of laggard retailing business attached. And people are valuing it as a struggling retailer, and it's just the wrong way to look at it. But the retail side has let us get down yet again today. And even just as annoyingly, they put the profit warning out at 20 past eight. So, you know, ridiculous. So, yeah, the CEO's gone. So I think that's a good thing. Fresh CEO in. Lovely cash generative business. I've just been looking at the cash. The free cash flow is superb. And it's still going to make nearly 100 million profit this year. So this is a good business, highly profitable, highly cash generative, big dividends. Its free cash flow, even after self-funding expansion, is very, very good. So absolutely not broken is the key thing. And I don't, well, obviously I mind profit warnings, but you and I have been doing this for 25 years plus. We must have experienced hundreds of profit warnings over the years. So you just get over it. You look at the revised figures. We think it's going to do about 15p EPS in the current years, which means it's currently on a P of about 12 or 13, which if you think that's trough earnings, then it's cheap. If you think earnings are going to come down further, then it's not cheap. So it's whichever way you look at it. The other thing I would say, I think they had pulled forward demand in the pandemic. A lot of people bought pets, but I've looked at the long-term earnings per share and it's now back down to the same sort of level it was pre-pandemic. So I think that factor has now washed through. And with a new CEO in, they get someone good in, the market's attention quickly forgets the profit warning and says, oh, this new CEO is going to do good stuff, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, I'm sitting tight. I haven't bought any more as yet because I generally don't buy more on profit warnings. I like to sleep on it and bide my time, but I'm certainly not selling. So your view, Paul?
I was just wondering and getting your view in terms of what's the reason for the softness in the sales? Is it the hot weather? Is it the poor execution, loss of market share, sort of competition from China?
I don't know. I mean, I think they blamed it on just soft macro, low consumer confidence, that sort of thing. But you're right. I mean, it's usually because people are buying the products from somewhere else, isn't it? So yeah. I think the new CEO needs a sharpened commercial focus on the stores. Sales declined 5% year to date. So maybe people are buying their pet food or all the other pet products elsewhere. Maybe sales are leaking to online. So yeah, clearly needs. But the key thing for me is the vets business is doing well. And that's the bit I'm interested in. The retail side doesn't bother me that much. Hence, for me, as profit warnings go, this one wasn't too bad. But sorry to any listeners who followed me in on this, because I was moderately bullish on it for a while. And so far, it's disappointed. So I'm sorry for anyone who followed me in.
Yeah, good. Okay, let's stay in the consumer sector. We've got Casper Mann. He's asking about Warpaint. And I know you had a good chat with the CEO, didn't you? Sam Bazzani, I think. And I was wondering whether you got to the bottom of the reason for the recent profit warning.
Yeah, I did a podcast with Sam yesterday. I have put it out on my Substack, but it initially goes out to premium subscribers only because obviously I don't charge companies a fee. It's because I like to be independent. So I've got to, you know, add some value somewhere commercially for it. It's been very well received by the listeners. I just invited him to explain in more detail, more color on what's gone wrong and what they're going to do about it. And he explained how it was down to about three or four specific commercial one-off factors, like a big customer in the UK going bust, and all this was in the RNS. But I think I and the listeners wanted to hear, you know, how passionate he was about it, and read between the lines, is this a struggling business? And he gave good reasons to explain why. No, actually, Warpaint's still doing well. There were things like a major customer destocking, but they see their EPOS figures. And he said the sales of the products are actually going up. So, you know, he gave, I think, good background commercial reasons on why this business is not broken and the outlook is in future is good. So, and I think I wanted to give him a right of reply because a lot of my Substack readers were pretty brutal in their comments on the profit warning. And I think it's important to let management respond. So that's why I did the podcast with him. And I do have a small opening position in this myself. I haven't decided whether to buy any more or not yet. So your view, Paul?
Well, I was just wondering in terms of, because I had the query I had was whether they were losing market share to other challenger brands, because obviously Elf is a similar, is almost identical to Warpaint in terms of a younger demographic. And it's obviously knocking the ball out of the park in the UK, and whether that had caused it, or whether they were, whether Elf were actually taking market share from the bigger operators, the likes of L'Oreal and Estee Lauder and people like that.
Yeah, I asked him specifically about Elf because actually a couple of the readers flagged that to me. And he said, look, it's a great business. We hold it in very high regard and everything. But he said, you know, we're not generally losing market share. He said that our sales are actually going up. And this was more one-offs. Like a customer going bust, like another customer having just a gap in its ordering schedule. He did say they were having difficulties in America, but it's only a small portion of the total business. But they did state that earlier in the spring in an update. So it's more, so I would say from what Sam was saying, it doesn't, you know, he's saying they're not leaking business to competitors and they're doing more rollouts into store groups, you know, who want to. He said, like, we're only in 10% of boot stores, I think it was, in Britain. So he said there's tremendous scope to expand further, and they're a tiny player in the market overall, so and they're global. So I asked him about Chinese competition. He said generally people don't like buying makeup from online Chinese suppliers because you don't know what you're getting. A lot of it is uncertificated and blah blah blah. So again, I got the impression they don't see that as a significant threat at the moment.
Yeah, good. Okay, that's nice to know. Now we've got another question on the software side. Came out results. We've got Frank is asking about Eagle Eye Solutions that we managed to luckily catch up again with their CFO and their CEO Tim Mason and their CFO Lucy Sharman Mundy. These guys do software that helps supermarkets and grocers around the world do personalized promotions, sort of powers the Asdas, the Morrisons, the Tescos, and loads of retailers, you know, around the world, etc. They lost a big contract about 3 or 4 months ago that set them back a bit, but they've won three new grocers so far this year. It started positively, and they made an acquisition, and their AI business seems to be doing really well also, which is about only fledgling. It's about 5 or 6 million of the turnover. What was your take on the business?
It was good. I mean, Tim Mason's a great character, isn't it? I always enjoy our chats with him. I mean, I think they're obviously they're very upbeat about the present and the future, but to a certain extent, I think you've got to focus on the reality of it, that the profitability has collapsed, or they had one big contract that made all the group profit, and that's gone. So for me, that's a big deal. So obviously,
just on that, Paul, it wasn't one contract that made all the profit. They equally do the profit around the company. It was more profitable, I agree, but because it's such high margin,
it made all the profit, Paul, because the forecasts have now gone down to zero. Just look at the broker forecast. 6 million profit last year, zero this year. So
it's the operating leverage. It's the operating leverage. We'll beg to differ, but it's the operating leverage.
I disagree because the facts are that profit was 6 or 7 million and it's now zero. So, you know, that's my view. I mean, you're not wrong either. It is operationally geared and, but that's the overall result. So they're having to rebuild profit before tax from zero. And they're very bullish on that. You know, they're giving us good reasons as to why they think that's doable. So the company's version of events is that this has pushed them back 2 years, basically. But they've got rapid growth, strong growth. I think it's a very impressive situation. And I think they will recover the profitability. I think the market's maybe been a bit too forgiving with that large recovery there for what was a very considerable bombshell. But I know you're more bullish, so let's see. I'll shut up now. And you,
I own the shares, so I have to obviously, you know, I'm a fan to say the least. And speaking to the actual man, I think both of them are really hungry. They want to drive this business with more clients. There's some big opportunities, particularly in North America. They won that sort of like real sort of, I would say, landmark contract with an extremely large American grocer's subsidiary in Mexico, which I believe, or we both believe, is we won't say who it is, but we think it's a big one, but probably the biggest. So there's huge opportunity in the Americas, and also equally, perhaps even bigger opportunity once SAP start actually pushing the button on their sales through that channel, which start from November onwards. The swing factor is timing. And they were transparent, they were honest that the forecast do need them to win more deals, but they have won three already. And if they continue to win deals like they have at a similar sort of rate, there's no problem. In fact, I think they'll beat the forecast if they do that. But it does, there is a lag between signing a deal and then the implementation, clearly. Yeah. However, you know, I think they were quite confident that they're going to start putting some RNS contract wins out before the year end. And if we start seeing that, I think the shares, and that's, I think that's why the shares are moving ahead of that, because yes. I think the people have had, you know, they've done a Vesta roadshow and they think, right, okay, these guys, they really can see that pipeline converting. And I think they're best in class in what they do, actually. You know, because because they're the number one in the UK for it, and the UK is light years ahead of anywhere else in the world on personalized offers. And with the AI engine they have, which is really is best in class, then I think people will start lapping this up, particularly when they start seeing their competitor in the same market doing all these and doing well.
Yeah, that's right. I was really surprised at their comments on that, saying how far behind America and quite a few other advanced countries are on personalized customer marketing, because they focus on buying the product shrewdly. I mean, you quizzed Lucy on the numbers, the FD, and I found her very, and Tim actually, very refreshingly open about it. They say, look, we ended the year with 34 million ARR, but we've got to achieve 46. So it's a stretch. But they've got good reasons to think, because of pipeline at advanced stages, they've got good reasons to think they can meet those forecasts. But I think if they do miss, it probably won't be by much. And it's due to factors outside their control, because the revenue recognition is that it starts when the client goes live. You know, and that is subject to God knows how many committee meetings at these large supermarkets. So I think as well that the trouble is, where you've basically seen your profits go from 6 million to zero, you've got to then juice up the forecasts to show a strong recovery. So I think maybe these forecasts for a 2-year recovery are a little bit ambitious, but not by much. So I think overall, I took a positive view of this. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, but I mean, they're not paying for that growth already, because you only got 1.8 times sales is the EV to revenue multiple. 1.8, that's peanuts for a business like this. But anyway, okay, good. We've got a lot of people asking about PZ Cousins, the sort of like soap and cleaner. Particularly, we had one earlier, Stephen Griffiths, asking about it. They're a bit of a sum of the parts, and I know Lord Lee likes it. They've got the Carex brand, the Imperial Leather. I think the Europe Vision's doing okay. They're trying to sell off the some of the Nigerian assets, and also I think they wanted to sell their tanning business, their tanning cream, Saint-Tropez, I think. But they couldn't get a good enough price. What's your take anyway on their results this week?
I was impressed, actually. I mean, we always disclose, obviously, I did follow Lord Lee into this. I thought his bull case, and he used to be a director of it years and years and years ago. So he does know the company very well. And you're right, it's a sum of the parts situation. Anyway, it's got lots and lots of international businesses that are very interesting. And the numbers were excellent. Profit was down, but the valuation is really cheap. It was about P/E of about 7, which for personal care type brands is very cheap, and it's because people don't like the African stuff, but they've actually sold a chunk of the African business for a really good price, and the proceeds of that come in, I think, in a few months' time, and that will more than halve net debt. So it's well on its way now. The balance sheet will no longer be a problem. You get a dividend as well. You're getting about a 5% dividend yield. It's not a distressed business at all, but the market is pricing it as if it were. They've decided to keep Saint-Tropez because they couldn't get good enough offers for it, but that's fine by me. I think my target on this, probably £1, £1.20.
Yeah, I mean, where would you put the value then to get to that 120 in terms of, you know, the Nigerian assets per share, the Saint-Tropez per share, and the rest of the business, which is they're going to hold?
Well, I think it would be partly a disposal. So, and Lord Lee reckons the Nigerian businesses are very valuable to a local buyer. So, right. You know, nobody with, I think inflation in Nigeria is running at, is it 30-odd%? Might be a,
yes. Yeah, it is 30%.
Yeah. And the currency's been dropping. So generally speaking, I think Western listed companies just don't really want to be holding those types of assets because it dilutes them, but they're actually very good businesses. So Lord Lee, and even if you write them down to zero, this thing is still a re-rating story. So I think it stacks up on for both a disposals breakup and a re-rating from a PE of 9 up to a PE of 14, 15, maybe. So you've and your balance sheet's all right now. So I think it's a good story, and these results very much confirmed it. And I think it went up 10 or 12% on results day, didn't it? So
yeah, it did. Yeah. My only take with Nigerian assets is getting the money out of the country, because clearly PZ Cousins couldn't do that. They just stored up a huge lot of Naira locally because the withholding tax and the exchange rate was going to be too painful to get the currency out. And then
that's been fixed. In the latest numbers, they said they've got no surplus cash remaining in Nigeria. They said it was all repatriated in 2024. So yeah, that was specifically confirmed in the results that that's been sorted. So yeah.
No, but when you come to sell it and the new buyer, it's they've got a problem. Unless they're basically, as Lord Lee says, unless they are based actually in Nigeria and they don't need to repatriate, it's going to be a problem for anybody.
Yeah, oh, I see what you're Sorry, I misunderstood. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. So yeah, Lord Lee is emphasizing this will be a local buyer. But look at the price they've achieved for some of their other
I agree.
African businesses in Nigeria, you know, they got good money from that $60-odd million. So I think it's a good story.
Yeah. And the existing Carex stroke, you know, cleaning business and Imperial Leather. I mean, that's a good solid business, that is. So
yeah, they've got all over the place. They've got loads of subsidiaries in, I think, Indonesia. It's a real collection of interesting businesses. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good. We've got Kate. She's asking about Big Technologies, which came out with some really quite appalling news in terms of their litigation last Friday, in terms of they're alleging the former CEO and founder, Sarah Murray, has been doing apparently fraud and counterfeiting documents retrospectively after shareholders. Anyway, what was your take? It seems like a can of worms to me.
Yeah, I was absolutely staggered by that announcement. I said to my readers on the day, read this just for, get some popcorn and pull up your chair and just read it for interest. It was an extraordinary announcement. But the shares have come back up again, haven't they, in 2 or 3 days. So it's a straightforward thing where the trouble is the case against Big Technologies by the disgruntled buddy shareholders just got a whole lot worse. But, of course, the other side is that Big Technologies are saying they can reclaim all that from Sarah Murray. So it just really, it could go either way, Paul, couldn't it? I mean, I think it'll probably work out all right for Big Technologies, actually. Yeah. But you have to be prepared for these bombshell announcements coming out, don't you?
Yeah.
And it just introduces a much wider range of potential outcomes, which, I mean, it does look cheap on fundamentals, though, doesn't it? Loads of cash. PE of 13. So what's your latest view, Paul? Because you did hold, didn't you?
I did hold. And the basis was that I thought this litigation was going to be capped at about 30 to 35 million, worst case. And they could claim that back after suffering some of the outflow through Sarah Murray because they have her shares, because obviously she still owns like 40% of the company. So they can just like cancel the shares or monetize the shares if they need to get, as a worst case. So that's how I viewed it. However, what's subsequently happening, the litigation has got much, much worse and deeper than I thought. And there was a report over the weekend by The Times saying the Serious Fraud Office has now been informed and is investigating. Now, If that is true, and they're investigating, you know, it's a criminal offence now. There's no way, in my view, Sarah Murray is going to settle out of court because nobody can actually pull the serious fraud office dogs off her. Because if she goes for a civil offence, pays the bill, then yes, the complainants can say, okay, we're okay, and that may sort of like take down the prosecution from the SFO. However, yeah, it doesn't guarantee it. And so if I was Sarah Murray, I would say, well, there's a chicken and an egg here. There's no way until the SFO have said no more, then I wouldn't actually do an out-of-court settlement. So if I'm right on that, I think this is gonna carry on and go and go and go until the Series 4 office, if the Times is correct that they have been brought in. So personally, I'm going to watch from a distance, however low it gets, because I just don't think this is going to solve it quickly.
That's interesting. Yeah, because the broker, I think it was Canaccord, a little while ago was saying they believe the legal stuff will get settled out of court. And Big Technologies did quite aggressively push the idea of mediation in the most recent update, didn't it? It said several times our preferred route is mediation. So it could still get settled. And with the SFO, they normally spend 7 or 8 years investigating and then drop the case, don't they?
Yeah, probably do, yeah. Okay, let's go to advertising agencies. We had a chat with the new CEO, John Carey, of the Mission Group. Very cheap. It was sort of like had a slide rule put over it by Brave Bison about 4 or 5 months ago at 35p. The shares have fallen back to about 23. He's now taken over the reins. His background is oil and gas, and also actually done some FMCG business and chemicals with Unilever and National Starch. He's obviously, you know, is a very, very strong appointment from a large company. However, I don't think he's got the sort of the background of advertising. What's your sort of take on the Mission Group?
I can't make my mind up on it, actually. I mean, I've followed this for years. I mean, I'm talking nearly 20 years, I think, or ever since it's been listed. And as I said to John very directly in our webinar, the problem with this company is that it borrows too much money, it makes lots of duff acquisitions, gets into trouble, and almost goes bust every time there's a downturn. They did that in 2000, and he didn't.
I remember, yeah.
Pretty direct, but he actually said, I agree with you. And it doesn't really generate proper profits or cash. That's why the dividend track record is poor. Actually, it's not that bad looking at it, but there was a big gap where it didn't pay dividends for about 6 or 7 years. But very limited cash flow. I would ignore the dividend yield. So this is showing, I think, a ridiculous dividend yield. I think they're going to have to concentrate on de-gearing. And they should have done that with the proceeds they got from a very advantageous sale of an American operation. So I'm glad it's got new management, because I don't think the old ones were much good. And John, basically, the new CEO, was very open with us, you know, on strategy. He said, having all these individual advertising or marketing agencies, putting them into a group and calling it the Mission Group, they're valued less than the sum of the parts. So what's the point of this group existing? So I think that this could be a breakup job where you get, you know, 40, 50% upside from actually the group breaking itself up and selling its bits off. So over to you, Paul, your views.
Yeah, I was trying to sort of like understand why he'd taken on this opportunity, because he's obviously worked at a much higher level than, I mean, I don't know what the market cap is of the Mission
22
group.
Million.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty small bet, you know, beer for somebody who's obviously been a worldwide sort of executive.
I know.
However, what I did get from it, He's got a very good understanding of what makes businesses tick in terms of process, structure, discipline. And frankly, as you rightly point out, it's lacked that for decades. And so just by doing a lot of good self-help and sort of like industrializing some of the repeatable processes, I think he'll be an absolute breath of fresh air to the business. What I would love to think as well is that he can combine that with the sort of the flair and the sort of the creativity and the pioneering type view and to get to energize his creative talent in the advertising business. So he can not only sort of like sort out the back end and the business, but he can also sort out the sales and create that, that get that creative juices flowing. It's very difficult balance to actually reach. And let's wait and see. But I was scratching my head why he's taken on this challenge. And I think if reading between the lines, I think you're right. I think the shareholders have asked him to come in there and look at all options here, because they've had a bid. And if he's saying the sum of the parts is higher, much higher than the 35 that Brave Bison put on the table, then I'm sure that's why he's gone in there to do that job, because I don't think he wants to be in the advertising industry for another 30 years, 20 years. I mean, I don't know how old he is, but he's over 60, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, no, that all makes sense to me. I suppose you could argue in this case that with four operating agencies, which will all have their own boards and their own CEOs, do you need the group CEO to actually be involved in the creative side? Mm-hmm. And so I suspect the answer to that is no. Lawrence Hulser and I were briefly chatting about this the other day, this week.
Yeah.
I kind of said, yeah, but shouldn't a marketing agency have somebody steeped in the marketing sector running it? And he said, absolutely not. That's the last thing we want. We want a strategy guy overseeing the individual agencies. So it'll be fascinating to see how it pans out. Probably not for me in terms of a personal investment, but are you tempted to pick up a few as a special situation?
The industry is just too cyclical for me. I mean, you saw that come through from MNC Saatchi this morning, because they had a profit warning. And I think the whole advertising media sector is being disrupted by the big guys, your Googles, your AI. I just think the traditional advertising is a tough gig at the moment. And it isn't something I'd put my marginal dollars, albeit having said that, if you want something as a turnaround, as a potential, stock that can actually double on a sum of the parts on a quick, then I wouldn't be surprised if he pulled it off and did it, because I think he wants to get a good shareholder result in the short period rather than be there for years and years and years, I believe. But I mean,
I think that makes sense. Yeah. I think this is a bit like Centaur Media, isn't it? Where they had all these various bits and Harwood pressurized them to say, look, you could sell these off for more than the group is worth. So, yeah, I would treat it like that, as a special situation. You could get a nice payout in 1 or 2 years, potentially. Yeah.
Okay, good. We've got Colin. He's asking about Alico. Now, this is my largest position, build tech software company. They do visualization and project management of sort of buildings and also property assets. They bought a business called PTech. I don't know whether you had a look at it. The shares, they came out with half-year results. The shares dropped a bit, largely on the back of one of the three brokers, as I later found out, changing their depreciation amortization figure, even though the announcement was in line, that they were all in line. And what I found out was that, I think it was Cavendish, just that have now reorientated their forecast to the same as Canaccord.
Have they?
And Simmers, who didn't change theirs at all. But anyway, because Cavendish are the only broker that allows retail investors to access their research note, people use that as a nod from the company, but I don't think
it was. Well, that's interesting you should say all of that, because we were tearing our hair out to work out what the hell was going on this one when it reported the other day, me and my team. We said, well, hang on, the company's saying in line, the brokers slashed the forecast. What the hell's going on? So I had a back and forth with one of the company's advisors on this and said, look, they sent me an email telling me everything was great. And I said, well, why have Cavendish dropped the forecast 17% then? So even they weren't sure. So between the company and Cavendish, they've created chaos here. And look what's happened to the share price. So I have been offered a call with them. I know you know them very well. So I might actually take them up on that and just do maybe a solo call, just so I can better understand the business. I like this business. I followed it for years. I think it's very, very good. And these recurring revenue software businesses are valuable because at the start of each year, they don't start with a blank sheet of paper. They start with an order book and recurring revenues that probably means they're 80 or 90% of the way to the year-end numbers, where before the year's even started. So it's no wonder people pay up for software companies. So I'm slowly, gradually coming round to.
I've held it for about 10 years. The key number from the half year, which stood out to me and didn't get any airtime at all, is the 12% organic growth in their ARR. And ARR is over 80% of the total revenue. This is doing really, really well of recurring SaaS and update software revenues. And the other key number, which got no airtime either, was that actually Cavendish increased their year-end cash figure as well by about 2 or 3 million, because this generates a shed load. The more it grows ARR, the more it generates cash. It is an absolute cash machine. And those are the two numbers. And to perfectly honest, if it wasn't my largest position, I would take this opportunity and buy some more. But it is. I mean, it is 16% of my portfolio because I've held it for such a long time. And I, to be perfectly honest, I mean, it trades at less than 3x sales. The industry trades at about 8 to 10x sales. This is going to get bought out at some point in time, and it'll probably be about at minimum 4x sales, which will be, you know, £2, or possibly 5x at £2.50. And the brokers have pushed their, you know, basically Cavendish have put, they actually increased their target price to £2.50 from £2. So this is, to me, this is, if you're looking for a software, high recurring revenue stream and growing in low double digits organically, then this is something you should have a close look at, because it's just been artificially sold off because one of the brokers effectively decided to catch up there. They hadn't caught up with the other two brokers and just realigned their forecast with the other two, who did not change their numbers.
Yes. No, those are all good points. I mean, you have got to remember with the cash generation, though, that it capitalizes a fair bit. £3.5 million is capitalized, so that has to come off. But yeah, the operating cash flow, free cash flow rather, is over the last 4 years, it's been between £3 million and £5 million a year. So it is, it is cash. It's a good business, I think, Alico. Valuation probably still a little bit too high for me, but if that trend continues downwards, I'd probably be. Yeah, I mean, I'm tight. I'd probably want around £1.20, something like that. I'd probably buy. But
I'd love to go out with you for a beer in the night. We're struggling to pay for anything in London, weren't we? Okay, let's. We've got Lorenzo M. He's asking about Brickability, which I think you own.
Yes,
you?
I do.
I didn't know, but I think they came out with an inline trading update.
It was good. I mean, and the market, as you can see from the chart, the market was clearly anticipating forecasts being reduced and profit warning, because we had a profit warning from one of the brick manufacturers, didn't we? But then Brickability come out and say, markets are tough, but we're trading in line. So I was really relieved by that and actually quite surprised. So, I mean, the PE and the yield are now the same number, about 6.5. So I mean, it has got a bit too much debt, but not too much. I'm very encouraged by this. I think this looks dirt cheap, especially after an inline trading update. So yeah, all good.
Yeah, I mean, I think, was it trading? Is it 6.5x PE, isn't it? Yeah. You're right. Yeah, I mean, dead cheap.
And 6.5% yield.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah. As soon as interest rates come down, all this sector's going to re-rate. There's no doubt about it.
And the trouble is, with most of the other bricks companies, you're having to pay up front for the turnaround. The beauty with Brickability is it's bottom of the cycle earnings and rock bottom valuation. So I really like that combination. I think you've got the upside in for free, basically.
Yeah. Good. Okay. We've got Brian is asking about Personal Group, which I think is basically an insurance and sort of like employment benefits type business that has done quite well. Has he came out results this week?
They were very good. I actually had a quick 15-minute chat with management.
I was just looking at the share chart. Wow, look at that.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
It's done fabulous, hasn't it?
It has done fabulously. Yeah, it's doubled in the last this calendar year. So obviously the first thing you ask is, well, is it up with events? And I would say yes and no. So if I would totally understand people wanting to bank some profits after that sort of rise, and just on a simple forward PE basis, it's in the high teens, which is a bit toppy, but you get very good divvies. It just generates cash flow. It pays it out in divvies. The yield was 7 or 8%. near the bottom of that chart. So retrospectively, I should have bought some, but I didn't, even though people told me about the story. The yield now, I think, is down to about 4.5% or 5%, obviously, because the shares have gone up so much. But anyway, my call with management was really good. I think they are on a 5-year plan to grow EBITDA from 10 million to 30 million. And that is all organic. They basically were just oozing confidence, saying we've got loads of market share to go for. We've just got salespeople out there winning new business. Really bullish. I think this is excellent, I have to say. So if you're a short-term trader, you'd probably be banking your profits now because it's up with events. But if you're a long-term investor, I could completely understand why people would want to just sit tight. I think for me, it'd go on my buy the dips list. Even no matter what the news, you know, market liquidity and market prices are not linked directly to fundamentals at all, are they? You might just find a couple of fund managers decide they want to exit. Could they crash the price? So I just sit and wait for those type of opportunities on companies that have gone on my buying list. And this one certainly is. I thought I was really impressed with the management.
What's the they're hungry, are they? I'm guessing, yeah.
Yeah, just quietly confident and just saying, look, we've got all these opportunities on a plate. They said they've got a big organic growth trajectory, no real direct competition. It's quite niche stuff, sort of employee benefits and, you know.
What's the secular growth in it? I mean, what's driving it, the growth in it? Is it basically just better execution, that they're just winning market share, or is the market expanding?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think they're just saying that there's not really much direct competition.
Yeah,
okay. That they just go into workplaces, they talk to the management and all the employees. They've also got a relationship with Sage, which I think is a sort of reseller. That seems to be white labeling the products. They're digitizing certain things. 92% recurring revenue. And they said, we've got no concerns. Those are their exact words about the second half. I asked them about the regulatory risk, mis-selling risk. And they said, because the trouble is these insurance policies don't pay out very much. And they said, well, the payout ratio has actually gone up from 25% to 30%, which they think is now kind of in a safer place, you know, and fairly comparable to other types of insurance. But I think they've got genuinely different and attractive policies. They're basically selling peace of mind. These are quite affordable policies that give people peace of mind, even though the circumstances for them actually being able to make a claim are quite small.
Are there things like what being redundancy cover and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't looked into all the specific products, but the numbers certainly were very impressive. I mean, superb earnings growth in H1. I think it was about 60-odd% increase in earnings. Yeah. Lovely balance sheet, plenty of cash, a certain amount they need for regulatory reasons. I asked them about M&A. They're not keen. They said they've looked at a few things, but they've decided they've got such a good organic growth and product innovation opportunity. They said they don't want to get distracted. So I said that, good answer. I like hearing that.
Okay. Good. Okay, we got Rebecca. She's asking about, she's in the sunny Spain. She's asking about 10 Lifestyle, which I think is sort of like a concierge service for a lot of wealthy people who join in sort of like their club, and they get sort of like free membership from the wealth managers around the world. But anybody who's got sort of like top end ultra wealthy people, they want special sort of dining facilities and experiences, but they seem to be doing all right. Anyway, she's asking, what's your latest thoughts on this one, Paul?
Dave, my colleague, looked at this one. I'm just trying to get my computer to stop pinging while we talk.
Yeah, I did wonder what that was.
Oh, it's annoying, isn't it? Anyway, we think it looks quite good. It's been loss-making for many years. It's moving into profit now. Decent balance sheet. Rather susceptible to contract losses, though. It does have, I think it lost a contract with Coutts Bank. And we almost went moderately positive on this, but Dave said, I just need another set of updates to confirm that this thing is turning around. But we quite like it, actually. We're almost turned positive on it. The only concern I've got on 10 Lifestyle is, how scalable is this business? It's been going a long time, They spent huge amounts building this platform, as, yeah. as people call it. Can it kind of scale up exponentially? I'm not sure. I think it could, you know, incrementally make nicer profits. So it's worth looking at, but that's my big question. Can it? I like yeah. things that could be 5 or 10 times the current size in the long term. I'm not sure this could. But have you looked at it, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, my only question would be how cyclical the business is. I mean, obviously, if you went through a tougher time, how many people then, you know, are going to be able to afford a very exclusive membership to then go around sort of like, you know, all the sort of the major, you know, places and pay top dollar for it? I don't know, to be perfectly honest, but clearly the ultra wealthy are more insulated from input cost pressures and budgeting than anybody else. But even so, I remember you and I, we've seen this so many times at the sort of like the great financial crisis and, you know, after the dot-com crash, people do, even at the top end, sort of pull back. They change behavior even at the top end, at the premium end. They can afford it, but they still change behavior.
Yeah, interesting. I'm not sure there'll be that much macro variance on it. All I'd say is I think it's worth people having a look at and doing your own research. I think it's potentially interesting, but probably not for me, but there we go.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move to, we got Bill. He's asking about McBride, which is the private label business that, I think we briefly mentioned it last week. They do contract manufacture for cleaners and detergents and stuff like this for the big supermarkets around the world, actually, but particularly in sort of Europe and stuff. Anyway, what's your sort of your latest view on McBride?
Positive. I was pleasantly surprised by these results. This was on Wednesday, yesterday, final results. So I quickly reviewed them pre 8 a.m. And at 10 to 8, I put up a thing in my sort of early, you know, pre-market open snapshot. I said, this looks good. These are going up. And luckily, that was the right call because they rose. I think they were up about 15% by the end of the day. Rightly so. They've key points. They fixed their balance sheet. The balance sheet is now fine. It was, you know, almost went bust a couple of years back, but it's really done tremendously well. Profits were flat, but the operating margin is the key thing. We were discussing this not long ago. The company had previously indicated that it was kind of making unusually high profit margins, and that wouldn't be sustainable. But they have sustained it, and the commentary was much more bullish. So they seem to, and I think they've said to you, or you've looked at broker research, where they thought the profit margin was sustainable. So yes. If that's the case, and this thing's cheap again, PE of 5 or 5.5 or something, when the pension deficit now is very small, manageable, that's not an issue. The bank debt is now back down to normal levels. So I would have expected the PE to be up at about 7 or 8 now. So you could have an opportunity here if, and only if, it can hold those margins. The trouble is the supermarkets, they're so adept at just squeezing and squeezing and squeezing their supplier base, aren't they? So that remains a concern, but I do think it's cheap now.
Yeah, and I think they said in their numbers, didn't they, that we've reached a sort of like the peak level of sort of like private label sort of like demand. I mean, it's absolutely, they're all flying off the shelves at the moment.
Yes. Yes.
And if that does soften off, then obviously that will make it a bit tougher. However, you know, the CEO definitely said to me that he thought it was sustainable, those margins, because the functionality and the performance now of the products are excellent. And
yeah,
you know,
well, that's a key positive change, isn't it? So yeah, I think it's good.
Yeah.
I think people have done well on that.
Good. Okay, we've got Jeff. He's asking about basically cheap industrial stock, Elementis. They do sort of like additives for cosmetics and aerosols that go in as a performance enhancing. But they do. There's a key asset is this Hectorite, high quality Hectorite mine in the States.
Which
should benefit from the US tariffs, because I don't think there are many Hectorite mines around the world, and therefore this supply could mean they've got one almost like, you know, a captive audience. But also, if imports now are having to have another 20-30% of Hectorite into the US, then they're going to have pricing power. But I don't know what your sort of thoughts on Elementis. I know some of the fund managers like it.
They do, don't they? Yeah, I can vaguely recall some of your fund manager interviews, this being mentioned.
Yeah.
I think it was a sort of serial underperformer, wasn't it? Is that, yeah, or am I imagining in that? And it's being shaken up. Yeah, it's in a nice improving trend. But yeah, particularly in the last year, this year. Yeah, it's yeah. I don't really have a strong view on this one, Paul, in all honesty. Mm. So yeah, PE of 17, forward PE, 2% yield. I don't know, you'd, on those sort of numbers, you'd want it to be strongly improving. We last looked at it, the H1 results on 31st of yeah. July, and we were just neutral on it, we thought. Here we are, on track to deliver $12 million cost savings. Yeah, so it looks to be a bit of a continuing turnaround, doesn't it? In yeah. line expectations, yeah.
I think the jewel in the crown is this Hectorite mine, and right. Which supplies a lot of their product. And given the US, the strategic importance of that has just gone up a huge amount with all the tariffs, because it must
oh,
be
I one see,
of the,
yes.
You know, because essentially the pricing power, it's going to have enormous, I mean, just going to drop straight to the bottom line. You know,
what on earth is Hectorite?
Basically, it's like a smooth white powder that goes into things like suntan in lotion, and also goes into aerosols. That is very, very soft and very smooth, and uses for creams and stuff like that. It's got
like a sort of clay or something like that.
Yes, it is. Yeah, exactly. It's like a clay. Mm. Yeah, it is. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I'll be stunned if the value of that hasn't extremely well, it certainly increased significantly given all the tariffs, but
interesting. And I'm assuming Harwood are in this one, are they?
Yeah, they are. Yep, yeah. they're in there. Yeah.
I thought they were. Yeah.
Okay, we got another one. Harwood's in. We got Vicky. She's asking about facilities of ADF. Now, this is the other side of the coin. I think these guys do the sort of trucks and trailers that support outside film production and television. They've got a new CEO, or effectively an exec chairman, brought in. Yeah, I can't remember what his name is, but anyway, he's doing that, and he's basically now changing the top team, changed out the CFO. The shares have gone nowhere, but they came out with numbers, and they did say they are seeing some improvement. They had a really slow Q1, a better Q2, and they're seeing better sort of film and TV production in the UK in the second half. I don't know what your sort of views on this one. Is it a turnaround with another one from Harwood, or is this something to avoid?
I don't think so. No, yeah. I've given up on this one. I take the view that the float was opportunistic when there was an artificial boom in streaming production underway.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, making losses now is probably the new normal for this sector. And the fact they've had to lay up part of the fleet, you know, tells you everything you need to know. So I think they're flogging a dead horse with this. So yeah, not for me, this one.
Mm. I could see them actually, given that I think you're right, they've basically idled or put on storage 20% of their fleet. If they sell those assets, which is obviously they can, then that reduces their net debt hugely and changes the balance sheet. They've got to sell it outside the UK. And I don't know how fungible the actual rental equipment is, but even so, that says to me there's excess spare capital that could change this. You know, it's not a difficult thing. You've just got to sell it at the right price, haven't you?
Yeah. I think a lot of the debt is lease debt, which is lower risk, isn't it, than bank debt. So that's a positive side of things. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what would you get for secondhand equipment that's not really required anywhere, it seems. But I don't know. I think for me personally, goes in the too difficult tray. And I think they've left a long tail of very unhappy people behind them, including Mr. Mills, who was pretty cutting with some of his previous comments on it. I mean, looking at the balance sheet, it's about 12 million net tangible asset value. Well, if you assume that some of the equipment probably have to be written down to sell it, I don't know. I don't think, compare that with 22 million market cap, I don't think you've got very good asset backing here at all. And they can't make any money. And the thing is, though, there's a big depreciation charge. So they could tread water, even making small losses, couldn't they? Because the cash flow would still be positive. So I don't think it's at any risk of going bust. But I think a recovery, personally, I'm not going to waste my time on it. I think it's unlikely. And if they do recover, it probably won't be that much. So, no, not for me.
Okay, good. We've got a final one. We've got Amanda, very popular share, Supreme. Basically, these guys do the FMCG products, go for vaping and also for lighting batteries. They bought Typhoo Tea, clearly drinks.
Yes.
And, I think 1001 just recently came out with an inline trading update. I think, was it this morning?
This morning. We didn't follow up on it because it was only in line. So not really any change from us. Here we are. Good momentum has continued across the portfolio. It's going to do more M&A. It's got a robust M&A pipeline and in line with expectations for March 2026. So yeah. That's good. You got two brokers both saying 16.7p. So you're on a PE now about 11. Which is historically quite high for what is still predominantly, in terms of profit, a vaping business. So I would say, I know it does other stuff, but the vaping is two-thirds of the profit or something. So I think it's priced about right, probably. Yeah, just neutral for me.
Yeah, it's 9.5 times PE. Right. But and if you said you've got, I don't know, a vaping business that is worth sort of 9 times PE, and that would be pretty low, then the rest of the business should be more than 9. And, you know, and anyway, I think it's some of the parts. The thing is, I think the CEO is quite entrepreneurial.
Definitely.
Very entrepreneurial and sees opportunities. And I think in the fullness of time, once I think the FMCG normal but non-vaping side gets to a critical mass, I would not be surprised if he splits one business off from the other and then then realizes that value in the fullness of time, because there's a lot of hidden value here.
Yeah, I mean, I think I totally agree with you about the CEO and the family. I think it was his father who set up the business, wasn't it? The webinars I've watched with the CEO, who really comes across well as just a hands-on entrepreneur. It seems to, like you say, spot opportunities for market gaps, buys underutilized brands cheaply. So the question is, we'll probably have to wait several years to see if he really can develop these brands, breathe fresh life into them. But I think it's broadly pretty good.
Good. Okay. Well, actually, I've got a final. We've got David Raywood. He's asking about Jupiter Fund Management. They're up 30. He says they're up 13% today. I must admit, I did look earlier on and I couldn't see any reason why, but the shares have just gone vertical, haven't they?
Yeah. No, I looked into that because I was wondering as well. The Peel Hunt have upgraded today and you're seeing very big movements on big broker upgrades and downgrades. It's amazing. And also, I think there was an article in the FT flagging I haven't read it because I don't have an FT subscription. So, yeah, it was those specific factors. But, yeah, we spotted that. So we thought, you know, 700 million market cap. You don't. It's unusual to see it go up 11 or 12% without an RNS, isn't it? So,
yeah. Well, it's doubled, hasn't it? It's doubled in value since the April lows. And for a fund manager, I don't think any fund manager has done anything like that.
A lot of them have gone up, but most of them have peaked and then have drifted back down again. Things like Lion Trust and various others. We like Jupiter. We were flagging it. This is stonking value back in the spring, but probably maybe up with events now. I don't know. The key thing with these fund managers, you've got to look at the performance of their actual funds. Yeah. You know, it's no good looking at, oh, it's on a PE of 5. Well, if all their funds, their main funds are fourth quartile, the client redemptions are just going to carry on until there's nothing left. But with Jupiter, I think their funds were actually performing reasonably okay. So, we like it. We think it's a good business.
That chart says to me, I personally don't think, I mean, it is a bit of a re-rating. Somebody's having a sniff on that one, in my view.
Yeah, that looks like it might be a bid, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I mean,
we'll have to check. I'll tell you what, Paul, after the market close, we'll have to check Sky News. That's where all the bid stories get leaked.
Yeah, there's no way their fund performance has improved so much in the last 6 months, because nobody has. To double, that just says somebody's either building a big stake or this is somebody out in the prowl into me.
I think you could well be right. But at the bottom, it was trading at par with net tangible asset value, and it was a PE of about 5. So, and you know, even now you've got a dividend yield of 4.7%. So it was woefully oversold at the bottom, to say.
Good point. All right, brilliant. Okay, well, thanks everyone for your questions. Thanks again, Paul, for brilliant insights and comments. Now, I'm actually got another pilgrimage, Second World War, Cold War.
Oh, you love doing those, don't you?
And Prussian history with all things Frederick the Great out in Berlin next week. So we're gonna
lovely.
We're going to skip next week, but back in same time, same channel, 2 o'clock in 2 weeks' time. So
2 weeks. Oh, well, our feed is in until then, Paul.
I understand you're out. Is it Gozo again, are you? Are you next week?
I'm going out to Malta on Sunday for a month. I've got 4 different Airbnbs booked, so I'm having a week in different places in Malta and Gozo. So, I mean, I'll just be working. I'll be out there with my laptop working 12 hours a day. True. But yeah. It's just to be somewhere where you can wander around in shorts and T-shirt while you're working.
Yeah, well, you guys have certainly put in a shift over the last 2 weeks. Wow, the amount of output in terms of what you've been writing and podcasts and interviews and stuff. So,
It's our passion. You know, that's the thing. Yeah. It doesn't feel like work, really.
Yeah, well, if you can maintain that, you'll be doing terrific. We are doing terrifically. All right, guys, thanks very much, and see you in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, thanks everyone. Bye. Thanks, Paul.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.